Hello and welcome to PodJumpers, the international podcast for open source developers. This is episode number 6, a discussion about dynamic languages, recorded September 20th, 2010. Hi, my name's Greg Turnquist from SpringSource. Yeah, that's right. For those of you that don't track my blogs or follow me on Twitter, I joined SpringSource team back in January this year. It's been a while since I produced a podcast episode, not counting the one I did about a month ago. But that's because I've been spending a lot of time just getting up to speed at my new job, and also, in fact, just a few months ago, I moved myself and my whole family up to Tennessee, and that's also taken a lot of time. A friend of mine had tipped me off that there was a local conference in the Nashville area called the DevLink Conference. I went and attended that. That was really exciting to go to. You know, it's great to get to a conference, and that's something I recommend to anybody. If you can find some money, you know, scrape together a few bucks and get to a conference once a year, it's really valuable. The networking was awesome. It felt great to be able to go meet a lot of new developers that had different perspectives, working for different companies. And this one actually was the first year at this conference that they hosted an open spaces forum. So they had four different slots set aside, and they had different people scheduling 15 to 30 minute discussions on different topics. So I went and sat in on a bunch of those. There was one about automated testing, where they were talking about different tools, etc. There was one I went to on branching and merging. That was really neat to hear, because one thing if you're not aware, the DevLink conference is a really .NET dominated discussion. So most of the people there work with the Microsoft products, and that's totally contrary to what I work with. I've got a Mac, and I've got a Linux machine, you know, with Ubuntu Linux and stuff, and most of my code development during the day is with Java. So I was sort of like the rebel or the person from the other side. So, you know, these people are talking about the different tools they use for code management and what strategies they use for branching, and they're using tool suites that I wasn't familiar with. And I told them that I was working with Git, and, you know, we had different views about, you know, how often do you branch, and the fact that we've been using Git for a few months now, it's, you know, Git is really super fast on creating a branch, go work on some feature, committing it, and then merging back. So we use lots of branching, and they kind of have the opposite view on branching, because I think their tools, it's very expensive and time consuming to create a branch, so they try to only create branches as necessary. So, you know, there was a lot of good back and forth conversation, and, you know, I think I learned a lot about what they had to deal with, and I feel like I was able to chip in my own 2 cents. And something else that fell out of that was one person actually scheduled a session to talk about Java and struts and Spring and EJB and stuff like that. And that's what I actually recorded. I just popped open my laptop that I had there and hit the record button, hoping I'd be able to have some usable audio material. And that's what I released for a previous episode. I tried to scrub it as best I could, but, you know, going back and listening to it myself, I can understand if any of you listen to it and basically just skipped it, because it was pretty hard to hear. But one of the people that I met there that was actually put together that chat session, I'm trying to coordinate with him because he's local in the area, and we're looking at putting together a Nashville Java users group or something like NJUG. So right now we're just trying to hammer out where we can meet at, and maybe meet once a month. So hopefully in the future we'll be able to record episodes from those meetings and distribute them through this podcast channel. I think that'd be some great stuff to do. Now I can tell you my partner in crime, Russ, he is just as busy as I am, if not busier. So it's really been a challenge trying to find a time when we're both available to record an episode, and we haven't been able to do that, which is why he's not here on this episode. And, you know, I suddenly had a desire. I've been having some material build up that I've been wanting to share, and so I just decided to go ahead and produce this episode. I don't know. To me, it's kind of a podcast version of the Agile idea of release early, release often. So I guess you can call it produce early, produce often. And that's something I want to get back to producing episodes more often. So I think for this episode, I want to cover some quick news items and then go into some more discussion all in the realm of dynamic languages. So first news item, Jython 2.5.2 Beta 2 has been released. On September 13th, a new beta release was made. There are several fixes, and you can click on the link in the show notes to get more details. Now, this is something I've been keeping a close eye on recently regarding Jython. I run my own open source project called Spring Python, and you can find the link to that in the show notes. And one thing that Spring Python provides is the security module has login options. You can log in with, add login support to your application through either you can use a database store that would contain the username and passwords and roles. For testability, there's a memory version where you can kind of hard code some accounts that have different versions of, expired accounts or locked out accounts, so you can just make sure that your software is able to deal with those kind of things. And then the third feature that we added was LDAP support. So imagine if you had all your user data stored in an LDAP directory server. We added support for querying the LDAP system. However, the Python libraries that I was able to research and find all were based on the Open LDAP project, which is coded in C. So essentially, they were Python bindings to a C library, which they were able to work fine with C Python, but that was unusable with Jython. So, I've had to publish that Spring Python, while most of it will run with Jython, this particular part does not. I tried doing some research on alternatives. There was one project that was trying to code a pure Python LDAP protocol support, but they didn't get very far, and I think it went defunct just like a couple years ago, so it wasn't really a usable option. So I said, well, this is Jython. Jython accesses Java libraries, so why don't I try using Java LDAP support to code an alternative solution? And for that, I had a really nasty stack trace pop up about maximum recursion exceeded, which I thought was really strange. So I tried Googling around to find a result for that, and I stumbled across a ticket that had been opened up against Jython that looked like the same issue where there was some bug in the class loader. Curiously, all the other bug information that had been reported involved using Jython inside a J2EE servlet container. So, I tried to read more detail on it, but they seemed to be reporting it was breaking at sort of the same point. So there's some class loader issue that may be very well that both servlet and LDAP support were both depending on kind of the same bit there. So every now and then I get an email about updates to it, and it seems like someone has found maybe a potentially coded solution to it, but the ticket's still currently open. So every time I see a new Jython release coming out, I go read the release notes to figure out if they've patched this bug yet. I haven't downloaded the version to test it out yet, but I noticed that this issue is still open, so I don't think it's in this release yet. So I'm keeping track of that, because I want to find out when Spring Python is back online with 100% support for both Python and Jython. It's another news item. Rails 3.0 has been released. This news came out on August 30th, and I saw a lot of Twitter traffic coming out of it. I don't know that a lot of sites are already chomping at the bit to upgrade to Rails 3.0. I know there's some new functionality, new features. It's a major release, so I can understand that probably a lot of production sites that are built with Ruby on Rails are going to keep an eye on things, but probably stay with their stable 2.x release. I got a good friend that he likes to develop Ruby with Rails things, so I kind of lean on him to give me hot tips on what the new Rails stuff that's coming out is, and I haven't heard him jumping to convert to Rails 3 yet, so I think it's kind of a wait and see for people on this one. It's another news item. Speaking of Ruby, Jonathan Schwartz, the former CEO of Sun Microsystems, has formed a new company. It's called The Picture of Health. Now, he's tweeted some information about the fact that they are hiring. They've got job openings. In the show notes, you can see the link to where he tweeted under his Open Jonathan account that as of September 14th, that they're hiring both Ruby and PostgreSQL peoples. So if you're a Ruby developer and you're interested in that, and I believe you're in the Bay Area, I think they've got openings for you. Now, the part about the Bay Area, that's speculation. If you want to try to get into that company, you know, that's up to you to contact them and find out if they got telecommuting or if you want to work from somewhere else. So I can't speak to that part, but they do seem to be interested in hiring Ruby people. And I noticed that there was no mention about hiring Java people, just kind of an interesting picture there, considering the Sun Microsystems is the flag bearer for Java for so long. You know, as being one of their key products, even to the point that they changed their stock ticker symbol to Java. So we'll see what happens with that. Now with those news items, I wanted to move on to some of the discussion. Kind of the meat of this podcast is I wanted to talk a little bit more detail about dynamic languages and, you know, some of the pros and cons and how this contrasts with some of the other programming movements that seem to be out there. Now, right up front, I want to tell you that I enjoy dynamic languages. I think I understand that, you know, what I found valuable in them is some of the same things other people do, is in that I think they provide some rapid development opportunities. A couple of the ones that I use much more often than others includes Python and Groovy. Python is something that I really got hooked on when I started reading Dive into Python by Mark Pilgrim a few years ago. That book provided such an incredible introduction into Python, and it showed what a terse language it was and how simple it was to put together programs and get ideas that you had into code and get it running. And I was really impressed by that. Another language that I found really, really interesting and that in fact I use is Groovy. And Groovy's incredible appeal is it was built from the ground up to really support Java developers. It's referred to that it's a superset of Java in that you can pretty much take existing Java code and paste it into a Groovy file, and it will compile and run like Groovy code. But then they have extra features, like they have closures. I think they have good property management, and that you don't have to use the getters and setters everywhere that you do with Java. But they provide an easy way to create sort of virtual attributes. If you haven't created an attribute in a class, but you define a getter method, that turns into a property the way you can access it. And one thing to indicate, I actually have not used Ruby or Rails, so I wanted to include some news items about the state of Ruby and Rails, but I can't personally tell you how good or bad things are in either Ruby or JRuby. For that, I've got several friends that do enjoy using that, and I kind of lean on them to give me the hot tips on where Ruby and JRuby are going. Now, I really do enjoy tinkering with different languages. I've experimented with a lot, and in my career, I've used several languages. You know, I can remember the days of writing production level C code and C++, as well as Perl's scripting language. And I remember building a system where I had a Java module that pulled for files, and then every time when it spotted some newly created files in a particular directory that it pulled for, it then ran the files through some Perl scripts to manipulate the files. And it was, there was sort of a messaging solution, a file-driven messaging solution. For me, that was picking the right tool for the right job. The Java was really strong in staying up and being able to run stuff, but then the Perl provided a really succinct way to manipulate the files that I needed to, that I think would have been too taxing to code it in Java. Some of the latest languages that I tinkered with, when I say latest, I mean in the last year or two that I've taken a closer look at, I found a really great introductory guide to Erlang, which I was interested about. I've heard people talking about actors and actor libraries for concurrent systems, and they say it traces back to Erlang. And I had seen something about Erlang as being used in a system that had 9 nines of availability. I mean, 9 nines is incredible. That's something like a few milliseconds of downtime a year, and that's a really impressive statistic. So I went and walked through that and found it kind of fascinating. I track blogs where people write about Scala code, and Scala looks really interesting with the idea that you can use object-oriented or functional programming paradigms. I've also tinkered with Clojure and Common Lisp as well. There was another online book called Practical Programming with Common Lisp, and I walked through it and found it kind of fascinating because I remember practicing Lisp back in college, and I really can't remember anything from back then. But so I wanted to go back, kind of revisit that and see what it was like. So, again, I'm sort of a technology buff, and I like to go back and I like to dig in and find out, what is impressive about these languages that we want to do with them. And one thing I feel about, going and experimenting with languages and always looking at new technology is I think it makes me a better programmer. There's times I've gone back to, I go back and again at the end of the day I write Java most of the time during the day, and when I look at problems with new perspectives, I think it helps me write better Java code. Because it's like sometimes, I remember studying like the Big Gang of Four book on patterns, and I was really impressed with the idea of patterns and the idea of somebody sharing with me some approaches to software design, about how to program efficiently and with metaphors that other people are going to understand. And today I look at patterns as kind of a ground zero way to get started with ideas. That's someone trying to share ideas, and now I look at it as well, here's a place where I think a good abstract pattern would fit in good, but there's other places where that's just a dogmatic approach to things. And I can totally understand where the anti-pattern movement came from, as in, you can really over-design stuff and just kill yourself with patterns. And so, this is where looking at other languages and other paradigms and understanding how there's more than one way to solve a problem, I think, really makes a lot of sense. Is, let's go try to learn the best from everything and see, how much of that can I take back to my current language? Is there, Can I write myself a reusable library based on these concepts that fits the bill? Now, you just heard me mentioning was Erlang and Scala and Clojure and Common Lisp, and one of the reasons I've been really so interested in those, and I'll say Scala in particular, is that there's been a lot of blogs and a lot of things recently around the whole issue of concurrency and the fact that the CPUs really are not getting any faster, and instead all the CPU manufacturers are migrating to multi-core CPUs. It seems we're running into performance issues where we need to speed things up and we need more resources, but serialized programming seems to have a limited shelf life, and we're needing to move to concurrency, and a lot of blogs are commenting that functional programming is the way to go, is what that's what we need, immutable state and functional programming, which is going to let us spin off stuff to multi-core CPUs. A classic solution is to use threading and semaphores and mutexes and locking, because when we're dealing with mutable data structures and we need multiple threads on CPUs, we're going to have different processes that are all trying to access the same shared state of data. And this is kind of the way it's done when you look at non-functional languages. But, I've had to debug supposedly thread-safe code, and we run into issues where we have deadlock or the system reaches a scaling point where it won't scale anymore, and we need to, I'm having to figure out, well, how can I make it go faster? This system worked when I was digesting 1,000 events an hour, but now that the system is receiving 100,000 events an hour, I can't make it go any faster. What's the problem? What can we do with that? And that's where, if you have too much traffic into the system and they're all having to modify a shared piece, one common shared piece of data, you get into contention issues. So the functional programmers, it seems their message is stop using the immutable data, instead use mutable solutions. And sometimes it's hard to bite off on that, because also some people come across as, hey, we've known this for 50 years, get with it. Lisp knew all about this, so, you know, go ahead and accept Lisp as your solution to everything. And I don't know, I don't like reading that kind of message, but I do like kind of the message of, you know, Scala says, hey, you can tiptoe in and use object-oriented programming, and we're saving, you know, we've kept the best and thrown away the worst, but you also have access to functional programming as well. And, you know, I found it kind of appealing, and I, you know, I'm excited to look at what's coming out of the Scala community. One thing I've used in past solutions is things like caching. You know, my previous job I had to work at, we had a huge volume of network traffic that came in that we had to digest. And so I found that certain queries we kept doing were doing several times a second against data that wasn't changing. And so we realized, well, that's a perfect candidate for caching. You know, cache the answer to a query and give it some kind of lifetime of, say, you know, 10 minutes. So every 10 minutes we could get an update to it, and that takes a load off of the back-end database, which would get beat up by the amount of network traffic. But, you know, if you reach a point where caching doesn't work forever, or you're having to trade in the integrity of the data for performance, and not all situations in these multi-core environments that we need to support, is caching going to be the solution? And I think that, you know, I feel like that's what stirred up a lot of the strength, because caching is kind of a, I don't know, it's a cover for relational databases. Relational databases are very powerful in what they let you interrogate. You know, you can interrogate the set of data to pull out what you need, but when you get to Twitterific volume, you know, you start wondering, is the relational database what I really need to solve? And I think this is what spurred on the what people call the NoSQL movement. NoSQL seems to have, I don't know, generated its own level of controversy. I guess any new idea becomes controversial, and I think being controversial, I think that's an unwarranted statement about NoSQL. I think the databases tend to be a more of a key value mapping versus a third normal form relational table set, but I think there's many cases where key value mapping is exactly what's needed, because that's often what caches use. Typically, you look into a cache based on it. You have some key, and you look in the cache saying, give me the answer. Whereas, you know, would it be easy just to, you know, dispense with the back-end database in the first place and just use the cache? And in one sense, that's a NoSQL data solution. So, you know, the podcasts that I listen to, the producers have, you know, they've gone and tinkered with things like MongoDB or CouchDB. And I think for different solutions, that really fits the bill, where what you're searching for is a different use case than what a relational database has to serve. And I think that the NoSQL people that I hear that write blogs aren't saying, you know, the NoSQL key value stuff is going to absolutely replace relational databases. Instead, they're saying you need to go find the queries that don't really fit relational database solutions, and instead use a NoSQL and mix the two together where it's appropriate. And, you know, for me, that's what makes sense, and I think that's absolutely non-controversial. Now, back to this topic of dynamic languages, I think, you know, all these bits of technology that I'm talking about bring to mind the fact that we need rapid development. We need to be able to crank out a solution. Like, you know, we startup companies, you have a business problem that you're wanting to get a solution to market, and the quicker you can get it to market, the faster you can get feedback and start improving it. And this is something I think dynamic languages have been amazing with. They're able to crank out development. They get rapid development cycles. Developers, you know, and the dynamic language community has said we need strong test tools. We need to have automated testing, or it doesn't cut it. So, you know, there the test movement has been growing, and I think it's become very mainstream. You know, I've worked in the past on systems that were really waterfall based, and automated testing was just an unheard of concept. I managed to introduce it onto a particular project and had reaped incredible benefits from it. So I think that's sort of a no-brainer for probably most of the people that are listening to this podcast. But the dynamic community has really spurred a lot of new types of testing. So not only do we have things like, we had JUnit for Java, but there's been variants for there's the PyUnit module for Python, and the other dynamic languages have their own version of the XUnit tools. But they've gone to other things. Like, not only do we need unit level testing, but there needs to be things like behavior driven development. And that's where I think Ruby really broke out awesomely with RSpec, with the idea of let's look at it from a customer's perspective of different user stories and scenarios, and if we can put that into a runnable DSL using Ruby, that's going to be incredibly easy, and it opens the door for QA and test engineers to go write tests from their perspective. So things like RSpec, I've seen that migrated over, and when I was at the DevLink conference, I saw the .NET version, I believe they called it MSpec, and watching, so I was able to sit there and watch a presentation on MSpec and saw somebody applying, BDD principles, and it was a really informative discussion. And it wasn't centralized on the .NET technology, but instead on this behavior-driven development concept that I thought was very, very useful. Another tool that's become very popular, I believe, is the Selenium testing, which is, this idea of acceptance testing through as a way to drive web pages. Now, acceptance testing isn't just confined to web testing, but I've seen where the idea of acceptance testing, which is a really customer-oriented test concept of, this is the way you navigate through the page, and if the page doesn't work this way, then the customer's not going to accept it. It just doesn't meet the customer's needs, and it's a very high-level test that orchestrates a lot of things. And the idea that they've built the Selenium project to make it easy. Well, I apologize. I apparently was using my headphones, and I didn't realize that the battery died on them, so right in the middle of my podcast, while digesting it in Audacity, I noticed about 15 minutes of material got dropped at the end of it. So I've come back to try to see if I could recapture my thoughts on that and end this episode on the discussing dynamic languages. I was talking about acceptance testing, and I really want to draw to a close that I feel that the dynamic language community has sought a lot of good automated testing solutions. And I think that this is a very valuable practice that's been added, that instead of test depending on not only on QA and test teams, but to have the software able to help test itself is a very valuable concept. Now, I've mentioned back and forth a few times, I've made reference to dynamic languages, to static languages, and I kind of want to bottom line it by saying, let's not dismiss any particular technology based on one or two data points. I think dynamic languages provide an incredibly rapid series of development cycles to release a runnable application, and to dismiss dynamic languages just because, it seems that there's some performance issues with it, I think is a nasty form of premature optimization, and I think that's the wrong approach to take. I think dynamic languages offer some incredibly valuable ways to solve problems that some of the static languages don't. There's several cases where I developed a Java system, but I embedded Groovy code because I had a more terse way to put in some stuff. I've also embedded Jython into systems because I knew how to do pattern matching to parse some files in a much more faster way using Python, and the Jython technology made it seamless to embed that into my Java application. So I think that there's some very powerful reasons that we should always look at, how do we mix together these languages to use them each for the right strengths, and the dynamic languages bring just as many powerful features to the table as our static languages do. So in closing, I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to hear my discussion about dynamic languages, and hopefully in the future we'll be able to release some recorded episodes if we can get our Nashville Java User Group underway and going. The
Spawn Jumpers would like to thank the Skype call recorder team who's made it easy to record Skype phone calls. Please send us any feedback or contact us about any potential interviews. We love talking about anything open source. Visit our webpage at pawnjumpers.com or send us a message through our contact form or simply email us at contact@pawnjumpers.com. All writings and recordings produced by Pawn Jumpers are published through a Creative Commons license and copyrighted by Greg Turquist and Russ Miles. The content of this podcast and website does not represent any of the companies mentioned nor their opinions. The intro and exit music is the upbeat Roxanne, Sweet Romana, and purchased from opuz.com, the site for royalty-free production music.
Working from both sides of the pond, the Pawn Jumpers are Greg Turnquist and Russ Miles.